This is a Day One podcast extra, bringing you a conversation between our host, Peter Wallace, and a special guest. For more information about Day One, which features outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, visit our website at dayone.org.
Welcome to this Day One podcast extra. I'm Peter Wallace, and with me today is the Reverend Dr. Scott Black Johnston, who last fall became the 17th senior pastor of Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City. Scott moved to Manhattan after serving as pastor of Trinity Presbyterian Church in Atlanta, Georgia. Before that, he was on the faculty of Austin Presbyterian Theological Seminary in Austin, Texas. Scott, thanks for talking with us.
It's good to be here, Peter.
You have described Fifth Avenue Presbyterian as a diverse collection of Christians who refuse to check their brains at the church door. And I wonder, how do you as a preacher intentionally try to feed both their eager minds and their hungry spirits?
Good question, Peter. I've been thinking a lot about this, about what stage in preaching history we're in. And by that, I mean, there have been times when certain types of preaching are in ascendancy and others, in descending popularity. There was a time when the three points in a poem were high. There was a time when the storytelling sermon was high. And I think right now we're at a time when the preacher as teacher ought to be in ascendance. And the reason for that is because I've got great concerns about the biblical literacy of the congregation and the theological literacy. We're a far cry from where we were, in the early 1970s when people were arguing, we've got too much, Bible and theology. We need more passion in sermons. Now I think what we need is some more education again, because people don't necessarily know the most basic stories of the faith, and they hunger for them. They're good stories, and they like to learn more about the content of their faith. And that's what I'm getting at when I describe the congregation as people who come with eager minds. However, one should never assume that just because somebody like me says it's time for the teacher in the pulpit, one should never assume that that means that teaching ought to be dry. We all know that the best teachers that we've ever had were ones who made the subject interesting and a joy to pursue. And so I hope that comes through in my preaching and in the preaching of all those people out there that are trying to get back and do some teaching in their sermons right now.
This nation has been through the ringer lately on a number of fronts, especially economically, and I know that has affected your congregation. What is the message people need to hear in times like these from their pastors?
I recently heard Barbara Brown Taylor say that it's time for sackcloth and ashes on Wall Street. And there's part of me that understands, that. I mean, we all want, whoever it is that's responsible for this mess that we're in to pay. Unfortunately, serving the congregation that I serve, I think that the mistakes and greed of a few have been used as a brush to tarnish many. And so there are a lot of people that work in financial services in New York, people who belong to my congregation, who are, I like to think of them as those math geeks that you knew in high school, the people that were really good with numbers, and they're still really good with numbers, and they've been faithfully executing their jobs at various firms, banking firms and so forth. And all of a sudden, what they feel is a sense of shame about their vocation when they themselves haven't been doing something wrong. And so what do you preach? Do you preach judgment? Well, yes. You say God does have expectations for us, expectations that we will conduct ourselves in an ethical manner in terms of finances. Do you preach about, astronomically high salaries and what that means? Well, yeah, you talk about that too. You talk about how we are supposed to be stewards of the gifts that we've been given. And do you offer comfort to those who are sitting there in very anxious places wondering, not just in New York, but all over this country, wondering whether they're going to have a job come this Friday? And I think that's probably where most of my weight has been, is on that place.
The economy causes a lot of fear, and you addressed the matter of fear in your Easter sermon on Day One. But how can churches both help their people identify their fears and deal with them properly, not just financial, but others.
I remember, I think it was a Monty Python sketch from many years ago in which some boys who were being schooled in a Catholic school were intoning, "Oh God, you are so very, very big and we are so very small." And I remember thinking about that and thinking, yeah, you know, what's this God at a distance? But sometimes I think we've gone to the other end of the spectrum when we make God so small. God's just sort of my buddy, but God doesn't have the power to spin the universe into place and to ground me in a whole different way of thinking about the world than the world wants to process. Now, why am I going into all that, the big God versus the small God? I think that our fears a lot of times begin to grip us when we have too small of a God. Mm. And if God is smaller than death, if God is smaller than cancer, if God is smaller than the relationship that I have with my spouse or a significant other, then fear, I think, is natural. But if you have a big God, a God who is sovereign, and Calvin liked to always put an emphasis on that. I got to mention Calvin since it's his 500th birthday and I'm a Presbyterian. That the sovereignty of God, having a God who is over all, is one way to start to put your fears into context. Doesn't make them go away. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean we don't struggle with them. But it sets us in a different sort of posture vis-a-vis our fears, a posture that allows us not to be wrestled to the ground by them, but to stand up to them.
This is a time of great change on many levels as well. And of course, your church is entering its third century of ministry and has seen many changes over the years. Do you think the mainline church should try to change the way it exists and serves?
You know, one of the most controversial things that can happen in any church is to change the hymnal, right? And there are probably more church fights mm-hmm. over moments when a hymnal's try to be changed. You know, so in the Presbyterian tradition, it's going from the green hymnal to the red hymnal to the blue hymnal and so on and so forth. So every denomination has stories of when they've changed the hymnal. The interesting thing, I think, about hymnals is that hymnals will propose a wide variety of music, and some of them are the old standards, and then some of them are more contemporary music of the day, of different traditions. And as each hymnal goes along, I think they tend to try and preserve the best mm-hmm. of that era. Now, what does that have to do with your question about change? I think we're changing all the time. And I think the thing is we have to be careful. Change for change's sake is not what it's about. Why do we change? We change to respond faithfully to the context that we're in. And hopefully I'm still changing and growing and maturing as a Christian. And hopefully the church is too. And the context, the circumstances in which we're trying to do ministry are ever-changing. And so if we're not trying to faithfully respond to what's going on around us, then we're dead. Then we're no longer the church of the living God.
We're talking with Reverend Dr. Scott Black Johnston, the senior pastor of Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City. Scott, early in February of this year, you presented the midwinter lectures at Austin Theological Seminary in Austin, Texas, where you used to teach. What did you lecture about?
Actually, I was the preacher at the lectures.
Okay.
So Tom Long was the lecturer. The first sermon that I preached there, I preached on the story of the dry bones in Ezekiel, where Ezekiel is summoned out to the Valley of Dry Bones, and he's shown all these bones and asked, you know, mortal by the Spirit, shall these bones live? And Ezekiel, in a good sort of Protestant way, responds, "Oh Lord, only you know." And I preached on that story, and I used it to talk about the church right now. And this is a good question to follow up on your question about change, because it seems to me that a lot of times what mainline churches are trying to do is they're trying to figure out what the newfangled thing is that they can do to survive and to be better. And I think what the gospel and indeed this story about Ezekiel, which is the gospel too, is the gospel says, don't worry so much about survival. Go to the dead places, the places where there are bones, and prophesy there. Go to the places where people are broken, where people are hungry, where there's human need, and speak God's truth, and don't worry so much.
Say more about prophesying. Your good friend and colleague, Nora Tisdale, I know, is focusing on prophetic preaching. How do preachers preach prophetically in this time?
That's a good question, because a lot of times the assumption is that prophetic preaching means bringing the hammer, you know, coming down in the congregation. It's wagging the finger. And while that is sometimes what prophetic preaching in the Bible is about, it isn't always what prophetic preaching is, because oracles of salvation are there in the book of Isaiah, for example, right next to oracles of judgment. And that is also the role of the prophetic preacher. And so let's take the Valley of the Dry Bones. When Ezekiel is asked to prophesy to the bones, he's asked to tell them, you will come to life. That's prophetic, to look at something that is dead and broken and desiccated, just dust, and to say, flesh is going to come on you, and the bones will come together, and a body will form that will breathe and be alive.
Well, that almost sounds like a comic book story. And I'm going to shift
flesh on subjects. Flesh, bone on the bones. You can see it happening.
Yeah, I'm going to shift subjects here pretty radically. I'm going to out both of us here. But you proudly proclaim in your official biographical sketch on the church website that you, quote, enjoy reading comic books, mostly superheroes, unquote. And so do I. In fact, one of my most favorite things to do with you is to talk with you over lunch about what the latest Spider-Man or Fantastic Four, what's going on there. So why is this hobby so enjoyable for you?
Well, Peter, I've collected comic books since I was in junior high, I would say. I don't collect them anymore. I've got enough comic books that I'm hauling around with me now. But I do still read them, and I pass them on to my children when I'm finished with them and let them read them and cut them up and make collages out of them. Why do I like comic books so much? I think that there is a deep connection between my love of comic books and my faith, in that I think comic books have always been a story about the struggle between good and evil. And the interesting thing about that is that as comic books have matured, coming out of the golden age of comic books to where that struggle wasn't just about a really bad guy versus a really good guy, to where that struggle moved to within the internal life of somebody like Spider-Man. Spider-Man's a great example. Here's one of these, this hero who struggled, you know, who didn't have everything perfect. And to me, that's interesting too. Again, as a Calvinist, I think it's fascinating to think of these people who are trying to do good in the world, but who are beset by their own egos and their own foibles and their own fears and the mistakes that they've made in life. The whole premise of Spider-Man is predicated on this kid whose actions resulted in the death of his uncle. And that flavors everything that he does. So it's a story about struggling for redemption and forgiveness and hope after despair.
And as you mentioned, a number of books have been written about the theological or spiritual insights that comic book stories can reveal. Greg Garrett's book, Holy Superheroes, for one. Another one is The Gospel According to Superheroes, a collection of essays. Say more about that. How can we learn about our faith through comic books? It seems like there are two different stories going on there.
You know, literary theorists say, Peter, that there are only so many true stories that can be told. And if you read comic books, one of the things that you're getting is a sort of riff on some ancient mythology, but you're also getting their take on the classic stories of Scripture. Mm-hmm. Now, some might say when you have Superman die and then be brought back to life, that's sacrilegious because it kind of looks like Jesus. But they are playing in some way with this theme of resurrection, and what does that mean? And to me, that's not a bad thing. I mean, it's not going to take the Gospel of Luke away from me when DC Comics is dealing with, you know, that kind of notion in Superman. It actually is getting people all over the place who pick up a comic book to think about life and death in a way I think that's pretty healthy.
Let me expand this premise. Should preachers and people of faith engage the popular culture, books, TVs, movies, websites, whatever, more in order to communicate our faith effectively to our culture? How can we do that?
Absolutely. I think that preachers should engage popular culture. Now, they shouldn't accept it all hook, line, and sinker. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, the only way that I can communicate to my folks is through popular culture. But I think any preacher worth her or his salt is going to realize that the folks that they're talking to swim every day in popular culture, and not to use the questions raised by popular culture, not to critique it at times, not to be critiqued by it at mm-hmm. times would be a mistake, I think.
Well, Scott, thanks for talking with us. And remember, with great power comes great responsibility.
Indeed it does.
Heh heh heh.